Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. We want to get right back into our 60-plus panel discussion of A Whole Life by Robert Seethaler. And last time we were having a great time talking about Andreas's view of life. We had a great time talking about Anna Haller. And I want to continue with talking about the humor in this book. And he really does give, like when he gives humor, he really does kind of put it sometimes in a negative situation. But he also very often associates humor with death. Right. And I think in some ways, it's kind of makes me chuckle, but I think in some ways, it is part of a whole life. I mean, you do have to die, and there are funny ways he does talk about death. Maybe we could just talk very quickly about Nana, and this will kind of draw everybody in.
Page 18.
It's page 18 with Nana, and we've talked about the women and Andreas's life, and of course his mother didn't do him any favors because she had him out of wedlock, and then when she did that, he had to go live with his uncle, who was not very nice to him. This is Cranstalker. We're going to talk about him. Even some of that is a little bit funny. But one of the important women in his life is Nana. And on page 18, right in the middle of the page, it says there, "Only Nana, the farmer's wife's aged mother, spared him a warm look or a friendly word now and then. Sometimes she would place her hand on his head and murmur a quiet, God bless you. When Edgar heard of her sudden death during the haymaking, and here's how she died, it says she had lost consciousness while baking bread, toppled forwards, and suffocated her face in the dough. He dropped his sigh, climbed wordlessly all the way up the past the alder cant, and looked for a shady spot to cry in." So it's kind of tender and sad, but it is kind of funny that here, she didn't pick a very good way to die. She died suffocating in her dough. And so I know that when I first read that, I thought, well, that's kind of gruesome. But then when you read through more of the book, it really is kind of funny in a way. And in a sense, people do die doing normal things. You know, it's another good friend of mine, his mother had a heart attack. She's trying to make a cup of coffee. I mean, those things happen. Death, we can't always, control when that happens.
That is one of the few times he cries also.
Yeah. That's right. He does. So we know that he's really probably a little more sensitive than maybe that it appears. So then they talk about her funeral. And again, he really does kind of put it into a funny scene. I think we could just skip down where she's riding. They have her coffin in the coach. And this is like at the bottom of page 19. It says they were just passing the smithy when its soot-covered door suddenly burst open and the smith's dog shot out into the open. So they're taking Nana to the graveyard, and this dog jumps out, and he goes after the horse on the cart. He says, barking hoarsely, it hurtled towards the horses drawing the cart. The coachman flicked his whip across the dog's back, but it seemed to feel no pain. It leapt at one of the horses and sank its teeth into its hind leg. The Hofflinger, which is a Hofflinger, is a horse. It's a short, stubby, hard workhorse, probably very similar to Andreas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it says it reared up and kicked out. Its enormous hoof hit the dog's head. There was a crashing noise. The dog yelped and fell like a sack to the ground. In front of the cart, the injured horse staggered on one side, threatening to drag the carriage into the meltwater ditch. The coachman, who had leapt off the box and seized his animals' reins, managed to keep both cart and horses on the road, but at the back, the coffin had slid and got stuck sideways. The lid had only been provisionally closed for transportation and was supposed to be nailed down at the graveside. It sprung open, and the dead woman's forearm appeared in the gap. In the darkness of the viewing room, her hand had been snow white, but here, in the bright midday light, it appeared to be as yellow as the flowers of the little alpine violets that blossomed on the shady banks of the stream and withered the instant they were exposed to the sun. The horse reared up, and one last time before coming to a standstill, flanks quivering, Edgar saw Nana's dead hand dangling from the coffin, and for a moment it seemed she was trying to wave goodbye to him. A very last God bless you meant for him alone. So again, I think when I first read it, I thought, man, this is really kind of gruesome. But really, it's actually quite a touching scene, is that here's one of the few people that really loved him, and she dies on him. And then it's like she is waving a last goodbye to him. Right. But then compares this dead arm to these beautiful little yellow violets on the alpine slopes and how they wither in the sun. So I think he was having a lot of fun with that scene.
Well, I think it's almost like theater of the absurd to see this, you know, because it's the juxtaposition of several things that are usually not put together. You wouldn't think, you know, that these kinds of images would go together, along with this grief, that you sort of have this vision of a hand, a dead hand waving goodbye, and the colors as they relate to the flowers and all those kinds of things. It's really absurd, and yet that's what gives it a lot of its humor and its charm, is that it's both in a context that you would not expect to see this kind of imagery.
Right, and I also think it also helps reveal about his own personality, is why he could get through things.
Yes.
You know, in his mind. I mean, if you have to realize, I mean, everybody has difficult times in their life. Everyone has to find a way to get through them. And Edgar had his way of getting through things. And he would look at things in terms of nature,
right,
or look at things in terms of, well, this is what happens. I mean, she smells like pork roast. I mean, it's a great smell.
He liked that. Yeah, it was.
And he liked that. Yeah. So I think that's really, again, that there's all these scenes. And again, when we talk with the younger people, I think it puts them off. They think, oh, you know, because death is really kind of scary to a young person.
Right.
But for those of us that have lived six decades and a half, or almost a half, we're kind of looking forward to maybe it being over.
In one form or another.
In one form or another. Yeah. So one other thing I wrote down about humor that I thought was really funny is when last time we talked about him being a tour guide in the mountains, and I think there's some really, really funny scenes with him being a tour guide. Let's go to back to page 113. And Edgar just, I mean, he grew up in the mountains. He loved the mountains. He just accepted the beauty that's there. It's not like it was this LSD high for him to go out into the mountains. And so Seetheller does show us some of these things. If you look at the very top of the page, he's given this tour guide to this young person, and it kind of reminds, now this is later in his life, it's probably close to the 60s and into the, maybe the end of the 50s, into the 60s, when the hippie movement was getting its. So he says, once during a short break at the top of the Zwanziger Kogel. I can't say that.
Zwanziger Kogel.
Yeah, you said it so much better. Thank you. Says a young man grabbed him by the shoulders, quivering with emotion, and screamed at him, "Can't you see how beautiful all this is?" It says, Edgar looked into the man's face, contorted with bliss, and said, "Yes, but it's going to rain soon, and when the when the earth starts to slide, you can forget about all the beauty."
That's cute. That's
really, I think that's just hilarious.
It is.
I think it's really hilarious.
Yes, I can just imagine some a young man up there with his long hair, and, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Just kind of just about you know, almost dancing around and arms up in the air, looking how beautiful it is. And yes.
Yeah. But then the very next scene, is the very next paragraph, he says, only once in his career, as a mountain guide, did Edgar almost lose a tourist. Again, this is really funny. So it was on a spring day sometime in the late 60s. Winter had returned again overnight, and Edgar wanted to take a small group along the panoramic route above the new four chairlift. And so he did know about the panorama of the beauty of the mountains, and he did want people to share it. He says, as they were crossing the footbridge over the Hausa Ravine, a fat lady slipped on the wet wood and lost her balance. Edgar was walking right in front of her. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw her flailing her arms, and one of her legs rose up as if pulled into the air on an invisible string. Beneath the bridge was a 20-meter drop. As he lunged towards her, his eyes were fixed on her face, tilting further and further back as if stricken with profound awe. He heard the wood groan as she crashed onto her back. At the very last moment, before she could slide over the edge and down into the abyss, he managed to seize one of her ankles with his hand, and even as he was marveling at the unwontedly soft flesh beneath his fingers, his other hand grabbed her sleeve, and he dragged her back onto the bridge, where she lay still, apparently contemplating the clouds with amazement. So again, that there is a lot of humor there, you know, in the book, and I just think, to me, Andreas is just one of these wise old mountain men that just say, you know, what's wrong with you people? You know, of course the mountains are beautiful. You don't have to get all crazy about it.
You know, that humor also is in the first scene of the book, you know, with Horned Hannes.
Oh, yes.
Where he's carrying him, and there's this interchange between the two of them, you know, where at one point Andreas asks him, are you dead? And he says, no, you limping devil. So there's this really sort of funny interchange between the two of them at the very start of the book. So the humor really starts right there.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's true. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. The other one of the really humorous things in the book is when the whole scene with Groller, when he gets his arm cut off. I mean, as again, you have this, I mean, if you can imagine what filmmakers would do to this scene, or how it's like, it could be the horror movie of horror movies. He gets his arm cut off, and then they have this whole discussion about when does Groller stop being Groller. We could just go there. If you have your book there at home, and you maybe passed over this scene too quickly, it's on page 48, I think, where it begins. And let's go up. Well, maybe we have to go up to the top of page 47. Sorry about that. I wrote down more towards the end of the story. I think we're going to need to do the front of it to really keep this going right. It says a splinter. They're up in the mountains, and I think the snow was melting, and there had been a big snowfall, and the trees were really pushed over with all the weight of the snow. And they're going to try and go up and fix some of the trees, and I think it's all related to the chairlifts and to the new technology that had come in. It says a splinter. So what they're up there trying to cut down the trees. It says a splinter the height of a man sprang from the trunk, ripping off the young lumberjack Gustav Groller's right arm, or Grustel Groller's right arm, which, as bad luck would have it, he raised high above his head again, ready for the next blow of the axe. Groller collapsed to the ground and stared at his arm. It lay on the forest floor 2 meters away, its fingers still gripping the hatchet. For a moment, a strange silence settled over the scene, as if the whole forest had frozen and were holding its breath. In the end, it was Thomas Maddle who was the first to move. He said, "That looks bad." He went to the toolbox, fetched a wire loop for scraping off bark, and using all his strength, pulled it tight around the stump of Groller's arm, which was gushing dark blood. Groller bellowed and thrashed from side to side, and then lay still unconscious. Now we can skip over to page 48. That gives you the beginning of the whole story. Now we'll just skip down. Just at the very top of the page, it says there's a sentence there. It says a brief discussion. It says a brief discussion ensued as to what would happen to the arm. Some suggested they should pack it up and take it with them. Perhaps the doctors could sew it back on. Others contradicted them. Not even the most fiendish of doctors who had ever sewn an entire arm back on, and even if they somehow managed to do such a thing, it would just hang there at Groller's side for the rest of his life, slack and ugly and making things difficult for him. It was Groller himself who had put an end to the discussion when he regained consciousness, lifted his head from off the fitter's shoulder, and said, "Bury my arm in the forest. Maybe a blackcurrant bush will grow out of it." So that's that must be the German, right. The German mountain man thinking, right. Or the Austrian.
Recycle it all.
Yeah, just recycle it. Says while the other men had headed down to the village with Gustl Groller, now an ex-lumberjack. that's kind of funny. Says Edgar and Thomas Maddle stayed behind at the scenes of the accident to bury the arm. The leaves and the earth it lay on were dark with blood, and its fingers felt waxen and cold as they had pried them from the handle of the axe. A little jet-black longhorn beetle was sitting on the tip of the index finger. Now, that's really kind of a funny scene. Mm-hmm. Here you have this arm that was once living. Now it's dead, but there's this bug on the end of his finger who is actually still living. It says, Maddle held the stiff arm out in front of him and examined it with narrowed eyes. "It's strange," he said. "A moment ago, this was part of Grolier. Now it's dead and worth not much more than a rotten branch. What do you reckon? Is Groller still Groller now?" So that there's this whole discussion goes on now between Edgar and Maddle about, okay, well, when is Groller not Groller? So it's really kind of funny. I'll just go on here. It says Edgar shrugged his shoulders. "Why not? He's Groller with only one arm. What if the tree had ripped off both arms? Well, then too, he'd still be Groller. And say it had ripped away both arms, both legs, and half his head." Edgar considered. "He'd probably still be Grolier, and even then, somehow, suddenly he was no longer quite so sure." So when do you stop being who you are? And, you know, I think there's sometimes in life we all, you know, have these identity crises. But notice, as Thomas Maddle sighed, he said he placed the arm gently on the toolbox, and together with a couple cuts of the spade, they dug a hole in the ground. In the meantime, the forest had begun to breathe again, and birds were singing over their heads. It had been a chilly day, but now the blanket of clouds dispersed, and sunlight fell in shimmering bundles through the canopy of leaves, making the earth muddy and soft. So, like any great writer, when he brings out, you know, something kind of gross, then he gives us something very beautiful to look at. But then they get into maybe a not so funny scene, but it's still part of this whole, I think, Seethaler is just a unique style of writing, is they begin to talk about death. And then I think this is Maddle talking. This is the top of page 50. He said, "It's a messy business dying." He said, "As time goes on, there's just less and less of you. It happens quickly for some. For others, it can drag on. Starting from birth, you just keep losing one thing after another. First a finger, then an arm, first a tooth, then a whole set of teeth. First one memory, then all your memory, and so on and so forth until one day there's nothing left. Then they chuck what's left of you in a hole and shovel it in, and that's your lot." So I don't know what you two think about that, but I think it's kind of an interesting discussion. So,
well, it's rather stark, but it is. It sums up life, looking at it from a purely carnal standpoint. You know, that's really what the physical life is. You know, you live through this whole life, and you do all these things and have these experiences, and on the way you're losing things as you go, and at the end, you lose it all basically.
Right. But see, the thing is I think we didn't talk about this before, but there isn't any character in this book that I could read that actually believes in God except for Cranstalker. Right. And even Cranstalker is, at the end of his life, is actually really mad about God. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And mad at God because I guess he lived his life thinking he was so righteous, and yet he wants to die and can't die. Right. He said God is like punishing him by keeping him alive. So I don't know what you think, Deborah. What do you think about the whole scene with the death and the dying and the
Well, I think that, well, we know we've talked about how death is a major theme throughout the whole book, but, you know, but death is part of life. And but the thing is, Edgar has a different view of death. I mean, he's thinks about it all the time, but by the time he dies, though, he's very at peace with death. You know, as death is the cold lady, it's Marie. So, but he does have these discussions, like he's having a discussion here, because he says, "And there will be a cold that gnaws the soul." So, you know, he's at this point, he's not, you know, he's thinking about it, not in a good way. Dead is dead, and that's that. But he, later on, he is really at peace with death.
Yeah, excuse me, but he got that from who? Though he's repeating.
Well, Hans. Hans. What's his name? Yes.
Hornhans.
Yes, right.
Hornhannes. Yes. We should have had Daryl teach this class, because I got all the names all wrong. Let's talk a little bit about Cranstalker. We have some time here, and since we're talking about death and Hubert, I think is his name, Hubert Cranstalker, he's the only religious, seemingly openly religious person in the book. And I do think if you look at, let's go back to page 12, then I want to go back to way back towards the end of the book when he's older. And this is talking about his view of religion and his view of life. I kind of get the feeling that what Seethaler's doing is he's probably picking on evangelical people. And I guess in Germany, my understanding, in Germany, the northern part of Germany is Protestant and the southern is Catholic.
Correct. And Austria is heavily Catholic. So
heavily Catholic. So would there be an evangelical movement in those areas as well?
Well, there would be. There certainly is always, there's this sort of ambivalence and this sort of conflict between those two groups, the evangelisch group and also the Catholics.
So. Yeah, so in the middle of page 12 is talking about when they bring Andreas as a very young boy to his house because his sister-in-law has this child out of wedlock, and then she can't take care of him. So this is Cranstalker's view of the kid. It says, "The lad was the only child of one of his sisters-in-law. She had led an irresponsible life for which God had recently punished her with consumption and summoned her to his bosom. At least there was a leather pouch around the boy's neck with a few banknotes in it. For Cranstalker, this was reason enough not to tell him to go to the devil or leave him at the church door for the priest, which came to much the same thing in his opinion." And so you can see that he really has this horrible view, and he's actually going to punish Andreas because of what his mother, the fault that his mother had. And it even says there, if he didn't have these few banknotes, he would have sent him to the devil or sent him to the church priest, which he didn't think was any better than the devil anyway. It says, "So now here Edgar stood gazing at the mountains in wonder. This was the only image he retained in his early childhood, and he carried with him throughout his life. There were no memories of the time before, and at some point the years that followed, his early years on the Cranstalker farm, also dissolved in the midst of the past. In the next memory, he saw himself as a boy of about 8, skinny and naked, hanging over the yoke of a plow, his legs and his head dangled just above the ground, which stank of horses, which is why his small white bottom jutted up into the winter air and received Cranstalker's blows at the hazel rod. As he always did, the farmer had bathed the rod in water to render it supple. Now it hissed briefly and sharply through the air before landing with a sigh on Edgar's backside. Edgar never screamed, which only spurred the farmer on to thrash him harder." And here's Cranstalker's view of religion. "Man was formed and hardened by God's hand to subdue the earth and all that moves upon it. Man carries out God's will and speaks God's word. Man creates life with the strength of his loins and takes life with the strength of his arms. Man is flesh and he is earth, and he is a farmer, and his name is Hubert Cranstalker. And so we know in the book that Cranstalker beats him so hard he actually hurts his hip, and that's why Horned Haines calls him you limping.
Limping devil.
You limping devil. So that was the only, that's the only religious figure in the book. Now if we go to page 93, I think this is where Edgar goes and meets him when he's an older man. And of course, I think if you read the book, you also know the story that when Edgar got to be 18, Cranstalker said he was going to beat him again. And he says, if you go near me, I'm going to kill you. And of course, he never touched him again. So this is on page 93. It says, this is very late in the book. And, you know, we're actually coming to the end of today's program. So all your listeners out there, you're going to have to wait for the next program for us to finish this story. So please write me any comments that you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.